and welcome to a new episode of Extraordinary Brains. I'm Max. No test today, partly because this is part of a three-part series on being the partner of somebody with neurodiversity, and that wasn't an area that Tess has much sort of experience of. So I did the interviews on my own, and I'm going to present them on that also on my own. So I'm afraid you just have to take it from me that Tess is great, and she's just doing her mock GCSEs, which is another reason why she's not getting too involved in the episode, because she's working hard and pretty exhausted. So today we're going to speak to Alina Hallinen, who we recruited as the wife of Tane Piper from episode 8. But actually it turned out Alina was really emerged as somebody who could talk very eloquently in her own right about managing neurodiversity and negotiating neurodiversity within a relationship and within a family. I thought it was fantastic. One thing you have to know about this chat is that I did not edit it at all, not because I was lazy, but because she speaks so clearly and she never repeats herself, and she's just phenomenal. So I hope you enjoy listening to Alina. I think she's tremendous. If you want to catch up with her on social media, she's at Square Peg Mind. Obviously, as always, it'll be in the show notes, but it's pretty easy to find as well. Yeah, go and tell her how brilliant she is, because she really is. All right, I'll see you at the end. So, hello, Alina. Thank you very much for joining me today for our very first partner special. And you're not only in the partner special, but you're a special partner for reasons that an extraordinary partner in for reasons that will come apparent. But I think let's just let you tell your story. It's our first one, so we'll sort of see how it develops. So you are married to Tane Piper, who was a previous guest. I can't remember the episode, but I remember we talked about gardening and systems, and he stood up throughout. What I wanted to ask you first, as a sort of opening gambit, is what was it that you noticed about Tane first?
You mean noticed when I met him, or when about relating to neurodiversity?
Well, it's a deliberately open question, so let's answer both.
I think we have a slightly unusual origin story, as it were. We were each other sort of like, he was my backup date, and he just, you know, he came to the date because it gets me out of the house. So no expectations all around. That's a slightly longer story, and we won't go into that part, the digress. But I think there was just something that clicked immediately, and we didn't quite know what it was, and it was it just sort of happened. And and I think, well, it took several years to realize, to come to these, you know, realizations about ADHD and so on. But there must have been something like a similar vibe, because I think for both of us, it was the first time for me that I felt really, really at home with someone. And I didn't really understand what that might have been, that was, until I guess later on with all the, you know, all our understanding of ADHD, then I guess we were just on the same fast wavelength with each other. So, which no one else had ever really been. And I guess it might be because of ADHD. So,
yeah, we probably ought not to bury the lead any further, because the thing that's special about the both of you is you both have a diagnosis of ADHD. There are probably many other special things about the two of you, but that's one thing that I'm particularly interested in. So who got it first? And were you competitive about who's had it most, who's had it longest?
Well. So the way that the story goes of our diagnosis process is that I thought this is probably now 4 years ago, I thought that I was depressed. I thought I was like high functioning depression. I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. And then we'd already moved to Amsterdam and life was quite busy and so on. And then shortly after that, I came across an article that was about women with ADHD. And then that just kind of piqued my curiosity, and I started reading further. I was like, maybe there's something in this. And many years before that, actually, I think it was in 2013, two people separately who were not very close friends, but they both of those women had an ADHD diagnosis in adulthood, and they both said independently of each other, not knowing anything about it, said, "Have you ever thought that you might have ADHD?" And I'm like, "No, why?" And you know, obviously with hindsight, like it's kind of obvious, but back then I looked into it briefly, and then in 2013, NHS didn't recognise adult ADHD. So I went to a GP, and they said, "Well, NHS doesn't recognise it. If you want to get an assessment, you have to go private, and you have to have private health insurance." And I was like, "Well, okay. Well, I'm not quite sure what the benefit is," and I kind of just left it. I googled it, and there wasn't that much information. And it looked like a laundry list of stuff like, well, that could be anyone. Obviously, not just anyone. It was me. But, you know, I thought that was normal. So, you know, I kind of hadn't thought about it for years. And then very quickly, you know, kind of ADHD, hyperfocus kind of way, I just researched it. I went, "Oh, yeah, this is me. Yep, this is pretty much, I'm pretty sure this is me." Went and got a referral from from our GP, and promptly lost all the paperwork somewhere in a bag. and it took me at least a month to actually send it off and get that process started, to get on the list of being assessed and wait list. And in this time that I was reading about ADHD, every once in a while I was like, "Oh, love, this is you. Like, look, this is you. And also, this is also you." And he was like, "Oh, damn. Yeah, maybe I should go too." So I actually went and got my referral letter first. But he was a bit more prompt about it and actually sent it off immediately. So Tane had I had my referral letter way before he did, but he actually had his assessment before me. So, you know, it's a bit of a funny one, but by the time it took at least like 4 months to, you know, to wait to get to the diagnosis, like the assessment date, and then a little bit longer to actually, for some reason, they took another month to kind of make a decision about it. It's very strange. And yeah, by that point, it was crystal clear to me that I definitely had an ADHD. And pretty much everyone I know who's since got an ADHD diagnosis, they were convinced by the time they actually got it. But yes. it's still kind of a, and every single one has had the reaction of like, "But what if I'm not ADHD? What if I'm just messed up? What if I'm just like, what if there's just something wrong with me?" Just before they get their diagnosis. And it's the same thing that happened to both of us. And it's kind of a, even if you're expecting it, it's still a bit of a grieving process. Every person I know has had that, like they're looking forward to finally get that validation. And when they do, it's actually still a bit of a grieving process. Like, it is actually true that is me. So that's kind of what, how it went. And then weird coincidence that just after I got the diagnosis, we moved to a new house on the same week. And then shortly after that, I stepped away from the business I was running with someone because of really bad burnout. And then shortly after that, sold my shares in it to him, and just basically could not work for about 9 months. And yeah, okay. So I think actually I wasn't depressed when I thought I was. It was actually ADHD. And then I think the burnout was also, now that I look back on it, a lot of it was to do with ADHD, in the sense that ADHD made some of those pressures and some of those events and things, and it made it worse. It's kind of like a, you know, lighter fuel to a fire. So, but you know, hindsight is great, isn't it? So,
but that's fascinating, isn't it? That do you think it was ADHD, so was it the fact that you didn't understand your own ADHD and you hadn't adapted to it that caused the burnout, or was it the fact that other people weren't adapting to it, or?
Yeah, a bit of both. So I think I could have been a better person if I'd understood myself, and there's a lot of shame attached to undiagnosed ADHD. When you get a diagnosis in adulthood, especially we were both, you know, closer to 40 than 30. So, you know, you have a lot of baggage and a lot of behaviors that you've, you know, coping mechanisms that are not always very useful. And also ways of behaving, like emotional reactions and things like that. Like, you've received a lot of negative feedback over life, and that creates shame. And it's actually the shame that makes, you know, it just makes everything so much more worse. And there's a feeling, you know, there's deep down, there's a feeling that there's something wrong with you, that you're a little bit broken and you've always trying to kind of fix it. But actually there was nothing wrong with you in the first place. It's not like a deep, deep trauma. It was ADHD. No. And but when you receive that feedback, it just becomes this kind of like toxic loop, at least for me. And I think for a fair few people, if they haven't been lucky enough to have a supportive environment. But we've our sort of ADHD journeys, if to use a cliche, have gone a bit like not in step, because I had that time to step away. And I really had to think, I wanted to think about, how did I get here? Like, how do I make sure that I never get here, you know, end up here again? And yes. I had time to reflect and change my lifestyle and the way I approach things. So I had that time back then when I was, you know, on sort of on sick leave from because of burnout, whereas Tane's journey has been, you know, it's been different. You know that from podcasts, so we don't need to necessarily go into that. And he's told his story. But he, you know, he kind of started the reflection process much later. It's gone in a different way. I think it's also because I had a bit of a head start. My day job has to do with psychology and decision making and behavior change. And my entire career is I've worked in market research for 15 years, so I'm used to analyzing how people behave, how they make decisions, and how they think, and especially how I think and make decisions. So it comes much more naturally for me to kind of analyze myself and to read about that kind of stuff. Whereas I think it wasn't as easy for him, and it kind of his journey's been different in that way. But you know, it's still it takes time to work through those things, and there are special challenges in a double ADHD household that, you know, I mean, one ADHD household has has different challenges, different frictions, different conflicts, whereas we have quite unique ones. So
tell me yeah. about those challenges and the joy of you. Because that's what we were going to talk about, isn't it, really, is that sort of two ADHD people and the journey together and what difficulties and kind of opportunities that provides, I suppose.
Yeah. So I have a very useful comparison point that a friend recently got her diagnosis really recently, like 2 weeks ago. And her husband is, does not have a diagnosis, but is definitely not ADHD. And they've been together for quite a long time as well. And she was talking about it just yesterday, how he's basically held everything together. Like he's the one who keeps the household tidy. Like she's very similar to me and Tane. You know, like you take a piece of clothing off and it kind of stays where it is, or you know, things like that. You don't tidy up after yourself necessarily the way that, you know, neurotypical adults might, more like, you know, like what teenagers might do or young adults do, that kind of thing. I make fun of that sometimes. Our house looks like two college students live in it sometimes, and not two adults. But she, you know, she was talking about how it's very typical for neurotypical, it's common for neurotypical plus particularly ADHD couples, that one side is holding up the fort. And that creates conflict because they often start to resent that like, why am I the person who's like making sure that everything, blah, 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 you know, and everything happens or tidy up. We also have that, but in a different way, because I'll come back to that, but we are in some ways just as bad as each other, that we have similar challenges. Thankfully, we have it's like a Venn diagram, that some areas we're both bad at, and then we have some strengths that we can kind of compensate. I think, over time, we've worked out how to kind of leverage each other's strengths. It's taken a lot of work, a lot of difficult conversations, and a lot of sort of willpower to work on it together. And they are not easy conversations, because a lot of the behaviors that are challenging are tied up in years and years of shame about yourself, so and how you are. So they are not easy on either side, but it's the only way we can kind of, you know, to make it work. And because we want to make it work, it seems kind of trivial. It would seem like a real, I don't want to say shame, but like a waste to not put that work in, because otherwise we, you know, we're great together. So, but it's just that the everyday life is a challenge for both of us. So we're not quite there yet, but we have our own responsibility area. So Tane's very good at keeping time, probably because not because he's not time blind, it's because he's more anxious about it. So he keeps us on time to go to places. And I'm much more sort of relaxed about time and not noticing it. So he does that. And I do other things that I'm much more structured at. So I do things like organize all our holidays. I do, you know, if we travel somewhere, I do all the like packing of the car because I have a sort of 3D way of visualizing it and things like that. So we kind of pick areas where we're strong at and then just kind of like, you leave that to me and just please just step away and just, I will deal with this. And that's kind of how we've slowly divvied up areas of responsibility. Still working on it, but we've kind of worked out that for me, like I had this realization some months ago that it's almost like we need to divvy up the tasks. Usually the ADHD chore advice or how to get chores done is pick a room and just pick, like split the responsibilities by room. Nah, it doesn't work because each room, it doesn't work for us that way because each room will have tasks that one of us finds more difficult or challenging. And the way I describe it is that there are some things that I experience more friction in doing and he experiences less. And, there's two factors to it. One is like how much friction you experience in doing that task and how motivated you are to do it. How much does it bother you? So things like I experience a lot of friction in doing the dishes because there's just something sensorially off-putting about it. He doesn't, and he's more motivated in doing it. I can just much more easily turn a blind eye. But there are some it's just something about it. Whereas there are other things that I experience less friction in cooking. It's not that I like it or I find it easy. I just find it less challenging than he does.
This so friction concept is a useful one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not liking it. It's not disliking it. It's just like a lot of things in households have friction to like because they're boring. Like let's face it, most household chores are inherently
really
boring.
Really
boring. So nobody wants to do them, but we have to because otherwise it descends
into domestic stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we do actually for a real marriage saver is having a cleaner who comes by and just about keeps us on the right track.
Mostly because
the day before she comes over, she's coming. Or usually the morning, there's a blind panic of an hour of like, she's coming. We must make it look at least, let's clear up the stuff so she can do her job. And it's always a bit of a panic. And it's basically the same thing. There's like a TikTok video of like, it's Connor the Wolf. And he talks about the system that get a friend to call that he's going to come over in 30 minutes and he cleans his house in 30 minutes because the panic that someone's coming over. And it's the same thing that the cleaner, she's coming and she's like blind panic. Geez, someone's coming over. We need to tidy up. And it's kind of, that's a good incentive. So mainly it's kind of like, self-imposed sort of whip to get us to tidy up at least enough so that she can do the basics of like the things that we hate the most, like cleaning the floors and bathrooms. And because that will never get done. It's just like a cluster of friction that it's just like, oof, yes, it doesn't
double
get done.
Friction. You've got this friction Venn diagram and the things in the middle because you both high friction, you need someone else to help you with.
Yes. And then she does, she does that. And it's kind of like, well, what's the big deal? People order takeaway and that's basically getting someone to cook for you. So what is the big deal about getting someone to do?
No, it's not exactly.
It's just something that keeps us vaguely together, us as in not us as a couple, but us as human beings keeps us together, that we, keep a certain level that is not, chaos, absolute chaos. There's a little bit of chaos in our house always. We're just four agents of chaos. Like our dogs create chaos as well.
We just laugh about
it because it's like we have two toddlers in the house, even though we don't. They're just like, well, they are, they're kind of furry toddlers on four legs because, yesterday I found a flip flop next to my bed, just one, a garden flip flop next to my bed. That's really useful.
Why would there not be one?
Yeah, why would there not be? Yeah, the reason it's there is because one of them picked up a flip flop and it just carried around the house. And, sometimes we usually only find one shoe, the pair of shoes you want to wear. It's like, there's only one. Where's the other one? Don't know. Could be in a garden. I found one shoe in a garden recently. Could be under the bed. Who knows? You put a nice blanket over the sofa and one of them pulls it down because, like, I want to lie on exactly this blanket. Like, Wonderful. That's great. Thank you very much. So we just kind of, I think that's led us to kind of accept, work very hard at accepting. I say that it, like, it's been easy. It has not been. It's been a lot of work to accept that our life is always going to be a little bit chaotic, and we have to stop beating ourselves up about it, you know, because it is what it is. But it's also, we have a lot of fun. Life is never boring in our house, pretty much. Mm. And it's just like, is it worth getting worked up about it? Or is it just like, you know, I don't know exactly what the AA statement is, but it's like, you know, give me the serenity to accept the things I can't change.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Serenity is really a good word. It's like, just kind of like, okay, well, our house is always going to be a little bit higgledy-piggledy. That's just what it is. And it takes sort of weekly, you know, mantras of acceptance that it is what it is. And we just deal with it. So
is there a little bit of a process of sort of examining and rejecting other people's expectations, or maybe even expectations that you've internalized from your upbringing of how you need to be, how to adult? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really, you know, the diagnosis is a starting point. You think that it's like, oh, it's all clear now. No, it's not. It's like peeling a never-ending onion of stuff that you didn't, like, oh, okay, so, oh, there's another layer of stuff I haven't dealt with, I need to deal with. That's great, wonderful. I thought I'm done here. No, it just keeps, you know, it gets a bit less emotional. It gets a little bit less, you know, traumatic as you keep peeling it. You know, like the little layers are, you know, not as bad, but there's definitely an unlearning process of you know, the feedback that you received your entire life. And people, like, you have family members who've liked to make fun, like, jokes about how you're a bit of a messy person. And it's like, yeah, but also, you know, we do a lot of, it's like accepting that we're an ADHD household. We start projects and we do stuff. And we, you know, we have a lot of things going on. Like, unlike my, you know, my older sister, I have two older sisters who are quite a lot older than me. And they're just different kinds of people.
Mm.
She, you know, I just have to accept that you do fewer things in life and you spend more time keeping your house tidier.
Yes.
I know, because we do a bunch of stuff, you know, and I have other interests. Like, it's really led me to challenge things like, so why exactly do you need to fold sheets? Like, who cares if your sheets are a bit, you know, wrinkly? Who cares? They will stretch when you put them on the bed. Who cares? Just roll it up and put it in a box, and, you know, no one else sees it. I don't, you know, my mum, when I was little, she would actually iron them or mangle them and make them all straight. Like, why? Why do I care? You know, just like, just put them in the box and it's fine. And it is what it is. Just pick your battles is kind of, it's an ongoing process of kind of letting go of things that you have carried, you know, these internalized expectations. Just let it go. Let it drop. And I think we've both made quite a lot of progress in that in the past 2 years, I think. And and life has become lighter, certainly. But I can easily imagine, you know, it's easy to say afterwards, like, oh yes, we've gotten to a good place, you know, we've gotten to a much better place, a good place about it. But it is a lot of work. And if you're not willing to, if there's kind of like, if you have resistance towards doing that work, or if one of you isn't as committed, it could be a real, you know, it can be a real torpedo for a relationship and a marriage. So, yeah.
Well, I think, so I suppose that's something that just sort of occurs to me, because you've got, it's always the same the way in relationships, isn't it, that sometimes one person is sort of carrying it a bit, sometimes another person is carrying it a bit. There's fluctuating levels of energy, and not even commitment's the wrong word, but how much people have got to give varies over time.
Yeah.
And I suppose in an ADHD relationship, that might be exaggerated or amplified, because my experience of ADHD people, as one myself, and working with them, is that one of the things that we have is a kind of boom and bust in terms of energy sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. There is that boom and bust, and kind of like, you know, peaks and troughs. But I think, we are, our expression, like our ADHD, how should I call them, cluster of traits or expressions. I think expression of ADHD is probably a good way. I don't want to call them symptoms because,
expression is a really good way.
I think how it expresses itself in us and how it manifests in our behavior and our is slightly different. Tane's diagnosis is predominantly hyperactive and mine is combined. Now, I actually, in the past year, 6 months, I've started to suspect that I might also be, I might also qualify for an autism diagnosis. It's very difficult to say because they are only recently, the DSM was adapted to kind of allow for a dual diagnosis. So there's practically no research at all, especially for women who might be both, because as you can imagine, it just obscures the picture. So I'm much less hyperactive than he is. Compared to other people, I am perhaps more active, but I'm much less hyperactive and restless than he is. I would say mine is more internalized, as it often is for women. But I also have more of, I don't know, it. I tend to take on the project manager role in the house, and it is difficult because it's kind of, I can take it on, but then I can't keep it up. And it's just that becomes that kind of a boom and bust of like, we're gonna get stuff done. And I lose the momentum because it's not really my job to be a project manager. You know, it's like, I'm not your mom. That kind of thing. I'm very, very aware of that dynamic and always fighting against that. But it's at the same time, it's like, well, you know, we do also, like, this is not to dismiss Tane in any way. He has his own responsibility areas that he deals with very well. And also he deals with, like, you know, I'm not without flaws at all. He deals with all the bills and stuff because I'm not very good at that. So he takes control.
So that's important stuff.
He manages a lot of that. And, like, you know, if it was up to me, our car would never be maintained and it would just probably fall apart very quickly. So he does a lot of stuff like that. But there is a lot of the, like, overall life projects that are kind of just like just a cluster of stuff that you don't necessarily want to do, but it has a long-term impact. Yeah, so let's say things like multi-stage projects, like, well, we want to replace our fireplace and put in a, like, take it down and put in a, you know, a different kind of, like, you know, one of those wood burners that are more efficient, or, you know, planning a house extension or a decking in a garden or things like that. It's not inherently interesting, but, you know, kind of an adult thing to do that, you know, it will bring enjoyment to our joint lives. It's a joint project. And, you know, things like that take, if someone doesn't take charge of, like, we need to plan this and get it done and keep on track, it doesn't happen because we're both ADHD. You know, I'm fully aware of that. So last year we had these kind of like family meetings where we had magic whiteboard all over, and we had them maybe once a month or something, and it did get stuff done. We were like, okay, we've tried different systems. It's kind of fallen by the wayside, as these things do, but it worked for a little while that we had sort of like, let's put everything we think we need to do and let's put them on magic whiteboards and then organize them. And I'm quite good at facilitating that because it's part of, you know, it's kind of part of my work. But also it's kind of like we need to find a system of taking responsibilities and making sure they happen. But it's not easy because, like I said, if one of us doesn't keep it up, it doesn't get moving. We're slightly time blind, it will just slip by. And
dogs are useless at doing their jobs. Do they even attend the meetings?
They don't. They don't attend the meetings. Or when they do, they complain, like, how long is this going to take? When are you going to take me out?
Useless.
And I know. It's totally useless. Their job is mainly to their job is to look pretty and keep us entertained and take us out. Actually, they are very good at dragging us out several times a day. And because otherwise we're two bookworms or computer worms or whatever. And we would just not get out of the house. But because you have two all-weather dogs, they don't actually care one bit whether you don't want to go or not. They will make
sure you do. Are you people for whom exercise is important for your ADHD?
No, God. You know, we're aware that it would be a good idea. No, not at all.
Do you notice, when you've exercised, do you notice that your ADHD is better? Because it's always said that it would be, but I'm not convinced it is for everyone. I'm just interested what you're
thinking. I don't think so. I am not convinced either. When I say exercise, we take them for, we're basically spending time outdoors. I would not call it like exercise in a sense.
Sure. Time outdoors, moving your body.
Yeah. I think it makes a difference for our mental health to get outside and kind of like switch off. And they're the kinds of dogs that they will definitely make sure that you're in the moment. The second you kind of like focus on something else, like, I don't know, your phone, they will be there like, hey, you're with me? Where'd you go? And like, they are very, very intense in a way, like making sure that we're present, which is brilliant. That's one reason why I really love the kinds of like quite intense dogs that we have. It's not for everyone, but they're very good at keeping you in the present because they're immediately you kind of switch off. They're like, hey, back in the room, please. Right here. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm here. So they're good at that way. But is exercise important? Well, I'll answer with a story that we, in the beginning of the first lockdown. So this is like, we're coming now to 2 years ago and all the gyms and everything closed. We're like, oh, well, we must exercise. So we bought a cross trainer. Now I can count with the times it's been used with the fingers of one hand, not two hands. Yeah, one hand. That's how many times it's been used. And because as useful a cross trainer would be, you know, like we both sit around a lot, our jobs are sitting down, it'd be really good. Yeah, but it's also really tedious. Like it is so tedious to me that I would need to both read a book at the same time as listening to music pumping at the right speed to keep me going. And it's still really difficult. It's I can't think of any, it's just like almost like Yeah, it's an emotional rash just to think about it. It's like, oh, God. You know, the one time I went to the gym when we still had gym memberships that we, you know, basically paid and never went enough. I went there with that and forgot my music or my phone was, I think my phone was too low on battery. And I had to spend 10 minutes on an exercise bike without music. I read everything that I could see in my sight and I was like, I am so bored that I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin.
Yes.
And it was like seven out of 10 minutes was like that. And it was, the boredom was almost physically painful. It's hard to explain it to anyone who's kind of like, happy to like, no, absolutely not. Like that is, it just cannot be done. So,
It's that almost pain of boredom that people, non-ADHD people don't understand. And it's really important.
Yeah.
I remember, I don't know if you've heard of the QB test. It's this incredibly tedious assessment. It's deliberately tedious.
I have.
ADHD.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a devotee of it by any means. I think it's got some quite significant flaws. But I remember doing it and it being painful. I'm absolutely painful. That was the point at which, quite a long time before my actual diagnosis, I thought, okay, right. Maybe this is something I need to look into at some point.
It's very difficult to explain to others, and it's kind of I'm a bit of a strange case of ADHD in a sense that because my work has to do with psychology anyway, I'm used to reflecting on my own behavior and on my own patterns and things like that. And I remember when I it was my diagnosis process or assessment process was pretty horrific, I would say. Very, very unfortunate that we had to go to that organization. I've now found out that other organizations are better. So it's not a negative comment on the Dutch healthcare system at all. But my assessor actually said to me, because I had read about, I'd watched Russell Barkley's videos on YouTube and Russell Barkley, the ADHD researcher. And as it happened, I was going to America for a work conference, and coincidentally, there was an ADHD conference just after that, a few days after that, in a town near where I was going. So I extended my trip. It was a work trip. It was my business, and I went to that, and I told her that, and she said to me that, and I'll never forget her face of like just I don't know if I call it. It was a bit of a shock that she said I was kind of tempted to write into your report a bit of OCD because of how obsessively you've looked into ADHD, and I was really shocked because it's kind of like
there's so much wrong with that.
You would never say that. Yeah, you would never say that someone has like
Well,
diabetes
apart
or
from
any kind
anything
of
else.
physical illness. Yeah, exactly. And I just thought, like, wow, you are terrible at your job. Like, you really don't like, seriously, I've waited 6 months for the diagnosis. Like, what do you think I was doing in the meantime? Like, of course I'm
Yes.
educating myself, but apparently not everyone does. And you know, that's
Well, I mean, the
always a
only thing
shame
we're
to me,
saying is
that.
that obviously, if you are somebody who finds it very satisfying and comforting to know everything about something, and then you subsequently think you might be on the autistic spectrum, okay, that might be something. Okay, fine, but
Yes,
OCD is a completely different psychological phenomenon, and
yeah.
I hate it being bandied about because it's so unpleasant to have, and it being kind of thrown into other things is
You
infuriating.
know, yeah, and why wouldn't you want to understand what's going on with you when your waiting time is like 6 months or so? Why would you sit around? Why, you know,
No,
I mean,
no,
some
no.
people might, but I didn't. So, you know, it's I don't think it's yeah, it's very, very, very strange. But anyway, and I've always been quite analytical. I read some years ago that a lot of girls with ADHD and also a lot of girls, autistic girls, they so this it's kind of said that autistic boys become little professors, and actually a lot of a lot or you know anecdotally a lot of girls with ADHD or autism kind of turn to when you don't understand people, you make it your life's job to understand them. So you study psychology and you end up in that area because it's like you just instinctively just don't understand how people work. So you're fascinated by it, and before you know it, it's like it's your job. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's me. So you know, I've made it my life's work. I've been interested in psychology since I was a teenager. So I'm now 41, and I've been reading psychology books of different kinds at the beginning, more self-help and things like that, since I was 15. So you know, I have had quite a lot of time to analyze myself. I didn't know it was ADHD, but I've gained a lot of tools in the process, which have actually been helpful for both of us, for Tane and me. Not that it's always easy to hear some of those so in quotation marks helpful things from your partner, because it
Well,
can
I
be
was
quite
wondering
annoying. It
about
can
that
be quite annoying, but
because you obviously have insight and understanding and lots of knowledge about psychology. How do you avoid being his therapist, I suppose?
well,
I mean,
by
that's a
tell
general question for a relationship, of course,
Yes,
but
it is, yeah.
specifically given your position.
Well, being very aware of that and kind of saying, this is not my job, you need to speak to, you know, need to find a professional to speak to. And he has. So he's always been very willing to do that work for himself, with himself. I don't know what the right expression is, but he has been very open to that and put a lot of work into it. So that has been super helpful. And I think if you have if one of the ADHD partner in a you know mixed relationship
Yeah.
isn't, then that can be super difficult. It's not easy, you know. So many times it has happened that I've told him something like, I think that's what that is, and he's like, no, I don't think so. Or just kind of like, fine, whatever. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, he's, you know, when he was doing some sort of counseling, and he comes back and tells me something. I was like, yeah, I've said that before. It's like,
And
I was like, yeah, 150 euros,
you
please,
need
or
to be
whatever.
very
It's like,
quiet, like to give time for the to catch
yeah.
up.
And it's like, I'm not a professional, but I have read enough stuff for myself that sometimes I'm like, yeah, that's probably what it is. And you can go and, you know, here you go, you could go find out about it. And he comes back, he's like, you were right. And I was like, yeah, I sometimes am, but unfortunately, it's very common with. So we also have a sort of coach who is both exec coach and ADHD coach. He also has ADHD, and
And so
we
he
but.
coaches both of you.
Yes, he does. I'll
That's
come back to that.
fascinating.
Yeah, and we kind of laugh about it, that it's very easy to solve other people's problems and not your own. So, you know, I am quite good at helping him, but there are in many cases like, well, you know, I've tried a lot of things, and I can't solve some of the things that I have tried, because I've also my job is to think about how to change people's behavior. I have a big sort of back, you know, toolbox or a library of techniques that you could use, and that's I'm surrounded constantly by these, like, this is how you change other people's behavior. Sure, yeah, but a lot of that does not, like, it's on a premise of neurotypical behavior and decision making. So things like, oh, you know, this is how, you know, piggyback, create new habits by piggybacking on routines. I'm like, what routines?
What routines?
What routines? It was a revelation to me to listening to a podcast with actually people who are like a behavioral science professor and, you know, researcher. It's like, yeah, so look, apparently people have fixed routines about the order of when they shower and brush their teeth. So it's what it's either a shower first and then brush their teeth or the other way around. I'm like, what? People have a fixed pattern? You have you don't have to write on a bathroom mirror to remember to brush your teeth? You know, like, what? But I can't say that out loud in like a professional setting because it seems so weird unless you understand ADHD. Like, yeah, yep, it's actually, you know, self-care is one of those things. Like, yes, I am a competent adult. I can do lots of really complicated things, except, you know, remembering to, you know, put moisturizer or, you know, things like that is surprisingly challenging. But yeah, so it's a lot of things that I see that are techniques for changing behavior. It's like, yeah, that's not going to work. Nope, that's not going to work. And I can tell you why, because it's predicated on neurotypical brains. And now I understand the difference. But so we have a coach who works with both of us, and I found him first. Like I thought maybe like I've been working by for myself for 2 years, and I realized at some point maybe a coach would be quite good to think about where I want to go and so on. And I had one coach first, but she didn't really understand ADHD, so she couldn't help me with things like productivity and like really hacking that. I've tried a lot of things, as you might imagine, and nothing really works. So I thought, I'll find someone. And I found Alex first. I can't even remember. I did a lot of sort of looking into internet sort of wormholes of like trying to find someone who is, how should I say this? Like a sort of advanced level ADHD coach, because a lot of ADHD coaches are for people who are freshly diagnosed, and it's kind of like you're working out stuff and like, I've already been there. And we spoke to one first and it was like, oh, this is too basic. I've worked out all of those things by myself already because I have had time to think about this. It was 2 years since diagnosed. Like I've had nothing but time to think about this. And so I'm really happy that we found Alex, because he was first an executive coach to working in businesses and that kind of stuff, working with high-level execs, and then he got his ADHD diagnosis and then added that qualification on that capability to his work. So he has a wider toolbox than someone who was working in something else and then said, I had an ADHD diagnosis. Wait, I'm going to be an ADHD coach. Woohoo! And their toolkit is much smaller than his is. And so I started working with him, and then I said, Tane, I think you should also work with him. And we have, and it's been really, really good, because we focus on the kinds of things that I suppose in quotation marks normal people would work on, but with the understanding that some of those techniques don't work. And because he's also ADHD himself, we have a better understanding. Like I don't have to explain as many things that I did to the previous coach, which otherwise perfectly really capable for us to answer stuff, but not when it comes to solving some of those ADHD challenges. Like obviously off the top of my head can't remember anything right now, but we also talked to him about different things. And this year we've worked with him for 6 months now. We had a little reflection before Christmas, and this year we're going to have our separate sessions but also joint ones, because our personal life or our life together spills over into our working lives and vice versa. Of course, I mean, we are now working at home all the time. His work is remote, my work is remote. So we have our own offices, but the, you know, organizing the same challenges of running a household, because running a household is like running a business. It is like you're just, you know, a marriage is like running a business, the business of your life together and all that kind of stuff. And you're kind of, you know, as a business, in terms that you're investing in your life together, could be like, you know, doing house improvements and, you know, investing in your own health, your joint health, because that is kind of long-term returns for your life together. So there are a lot of things like that. It's like, it's because I have a business background. Maybe someone thinks it's cold-hearted to think of it that way, but it really is like, we are kind of, you know, when we don't look after our own health, we're eating from the load, in the sense that we're not investing in a long-term good quality of life together. you know, and, you know, thinking about how we improve our house is investing in our long-term life together.
Exactly.
But, you know, I understand that, but on the short term, it's hard to get those things done.
To take a relatively hard-nosed attitude to something like that, though, in a way, takes some of the pressure off, takes some of the kind of, again, expectations off of how, you know, how marriage, you know, needs to be a sort of wonderful dream. And actually, if you take a relatively practical approach to it, actually some of that kind of distress from the difference, disparity between reality and the kind of ideal as portrayed in the media, actually some comes away if you just accept that to an extent you're running a business together.
Well, yeah, and I think it's also, if the business isn't running smoothly, then that eats into your energy, and that, you know, that's all the energy that's left over for all the good stuff and all the fun stuff. But if you have a really disorganized, you know, if a really inefficient organization in your business, then that takes up, you know, you're wasting energy in running the household business. That energy that could be going for, that is actually the nice part of your relationship and a relationship with someone.
Fund it.
So, yeah, exactly. So, you know, running it more efficiently. And also the other thing is that when there's unfinished business, unfinished stuff, like unfinished projects, or, you know, things like, oh, I should be doing that. The thing with an ADHD brain is that it kind of hangs around. Those incompletions hang around, and you carry them around, and then they kind of like dredge some of the shame with them, and suddenly something that doesn't need to be a big deal is actually starts to get very heavy. Finding a system that, you know, kind of, as you say, like takes, if you approach it like, we need to, you know, there's nothing personal, we need to run this household like it's a business, it takes it out of, you know, it's not personal, it is something that we're working on together, and we can, you know, we can discuss things rather than people. It's not like you never do this, like, well, we need to get this done.
This needs
what
to
is
be
the
done,
best way? Yes. Yeah, yeah. This stuff needs to get done. The reality is that we both hate doing it. You know, how are we going to get it? You know, how will we get this done? And also, it's like this thing is like, I'm maybe maybe there is a gender role, which I'm painfully aware of, that I have internalized some of those expectations, that it is a, you know, I can't say that I support it, but it's an internalized thing that's very hard to fight, that the woman runs the household. Like, I'm aware of how ridiculous it is. A household's disorganization is always judged on the woman. It always is. It will never be judged like, oh, he must be disorganized. No, it's like, we're both busy professionals. It is not my job to run a household. No. But and he doesn't think that either. But in reality, the internalized beliefs in me mean that I'm much more sort of like likely to do the grudge work, because it's just like, it just drives, it sort of drives you whether you want it or not. And then, you know, meta level of being annoyed that it does, and I end up doing it. It's like, this is not right. I don't want to do this. No. And he's like, well, I don't want you to do either. It's like, fine. We're in agreement of that, but how do we practically solve this? And that's kind of why we're working with it. We're not working with a therapist for a reason, because it's not an emotion. It's not an emotional thing. It's a really, really practical thing. That's why we're working with him together. And I would say that there are some transferable skills. Like, if we learn how to do these really boring things that are important in our personal lives or run our household, then that has a spillover effect to our skills in working life, like doing things that we do a better job at sort of, you know, compensating for in a working environment, that it doesn't impact our work. We do our work, you know, our jobs well, but there is possibly a bit more of a, how should I call it, sort of a, it could be an energy drain, because you can get something done well or a project management at work, but it takes it takes more energy than it would for other people. Or you kind of like, you know, the proverbial duck that pedals hard, you know, under the surface, looks smooth sailing, but actually you're pedaling way harder than anyone else. So I think there's, you know, I sort of sense that there is a, you know, positive spillover effect. If we learn to do these grudge stuff in our house, in our joint lives more efficiently, with less emotion, that's kind of, it sounds a bit horrible, but I've learned over time that the less emotion you learn to attach to, or like unattach emotion from stuff like that. And it makes it easier to do because
there's plenty of stuff that you should attach emotion to. So yes. Don't put it on the housework. You know,
yes, yeah, or you know, or things like that. It's like it's just kind of like it's just household business. You know, it's yeah. It's not personal. We need to get this stuff done. Who is going to get it done, and how are we going to, you know, divide this? I am kind of an advocate of like just take the emotion out of it and just approach it as practically as possible. Easier said than done, but you know, I think that's something that we try to do. That yeah, I don't know where we're doing that, but yeah.
I just wanted to go back to another point you made about, we're sort of about the internalized gender stereotypes. Or, I mean, how are you, do you ever get judged by friends or family, either in a gendered way or in a neurotypical way? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you ever feel that your relationship to other people who are not this kind of ADHD household is affected by your ADHD-ness, your collective ADHD-ness?
I would say not really, but the reason for that is probably because, well, first of all, we live in a different country to both of our families. So my relatives live in Finland and his relatives live in the UK. So, you know, there's that part that, you know, we don't live in a sort of closely knit network of people or families.
You've got mother-in-law popping around and looking at
and she's super lovely as well. Like Tane's mum is would not be like that anyway. Dare I say she's not necessarily the super tidy organized person herself. So you know there isn't that kind of like judgment there. And she knows her son. Let's put it that way. She knows what her son is like, so it's okay. But you know, we don't really have that kind of pressure from our families. And then I would say that 2 years of COVID and, you know, hardly anyone coming for a visit has kind of taken the pressure. Like there isn't even that no one comes around. It's like, okay, well, I guess we could just live however, you know, if we want to live like, you know, pigs in a whatever where pigs live, that's kind of fine because like no one's coming around ever. So that takes a pressure off quite a bit. But I think it's more internalized at this stage. And sometimes it's because I'm aware of how social like impacts social norms. And I am used to analyzing people's behavior and my own behavior with various different frameworks and things like that. So I'm sort of extra super rational in a sense, like I'm not a big Christmas person, and I kind of just analyze things like, well, a lot of these meanings are arbitrary anyway. I mean, you know, things like we attach arbitrary meanings to things and then get stressed about those meanings that we've kind of put them on ourselves. Like they're just in our minds. Like I'll give you an example so that it makes a bit more sense. Living between cultures has that effect on you. So in Finland, you would celebrate Christmas on Christmas Eve. So Christmas Eve is when everyone's celebrating and saying, have a, you know, Merry Christmas or whatever on Facebook. And then Christmas Eve is nothing in the UK. So I lived in the UK for 15 years, and it's like, well, Christmas Eve is kind of like a normal day. And then Christmas Day, and Christmas Day is when it all happens. And then Christmas Day in Finland is like, well, it's already gone, you know? So, you know, I've lived for, you know, almost 20 years in this kind of weird limbo of like, well, when is Christmas anyway?
When is Christmas?
What does it
ultimately, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Like, it's just a day and we all make a big deal about it, but actually it doesn't matter what day it is because it's a different day elsewhere. And the Dutch can, you know, they just muddy the waters further because there's Sinterklaas, which is beginning of December. So Christmas, you know, that's when kids get presents, and it's kind of like all on the wrong time. And, you know, Santa or Sinterklaas comes, you know, way earlier than Christmas. And then Christmas is kind of like, meh.
Well, it sort of makes sense because he's got quite a lot of the world to cover. So if he starts in November, then the maths works out a lot easier than trying to do it all in one night.
Yeah, exactly. But so that's just an example of suddenly you're just like, well, what does it all mean anyway? And, you know, I don't know. We don't really have that kind of pressure. I think it has been more sort of internalized pressure that I've taken on. And, you know, some of those things, I don't know. It is difficult because sometimes I just like, right, well, what happens if I don't keep it going? And it's like, well, this is what happens. You know, we had No, I'm not going to tell that story. But there, let's just say that there was a specific thing that was his responsibility area, and it nearly went. It kind of ended up with me having to rescue the situation. So that's now a benchmark of like, that will never happen again. No one's life was in danger. It's more about an item of importance. And it's like, this was your responsibility, and I didn't keep track of it because it was your area. And I ended up rescuing the situation. I never want this to happen again. This is not good. And since then, that was kind of a pivotal point that things changed. I'm sad to admit that I do bring it up. It's like, right, we're never having that again. Remember that. Okay. And it's like, I'm aware that this is punching below the belt, but like, this cannot happen. You know, like, it's not my job to rescue things. Even if I don't keep track of things, sometimes they will just slip through the net, and then it becomes my job anyway. Yeah. But we've had those conversations, and we, you know,
as long as you have those conversations, then you can work through it.
Yeah, we have them, and you know, to Tane's huge credit, he has taken that stuff on board, and especially working with the coach, as it, like, therapist is a therapist, and counselor is a counselor, but a coach can be hugely helpful in doing something in practice. You can talk about your emotions, you know, endlessly, but it's not always about that. Sometimes, like, well, you know, we're kind of like, yeah, we're good, but actually, the emotional stuff now comes up because we have to deal with something in practice, and dealing with it in practice removes the trigger for the emotional stuff. And talking about it will not make a difference. It's not an emotional reason. It's just ADHD, you know, like, it is just like object permanence, you know, and can't see it, doesn't exist, la, 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 you know, things like this, understanding.
So just to quickly explain object permanence.
So kind of like out of sight, out of mind. So if you know, the kind of thing that if you tidying things up into drawers sometimes means that you buy a second one of something because you can't find it again. You've forgotten you even have it, or you know, if you have a planner that you put away in a drawer, like tidy up, then you just forget that. You just don't remember things that you cannot see. It's like the organizational system of having things in piles so that you can see it as soon as you put it away, which is the typical like Marie Kondo kind of like ideology of tidy things away and keep it minimalistic. Like, yeah, keep it minimalistic. And I'll never remember to do that thing. You know, a hobby that you like or pastime, you put it away and it's like, it doesn't exist. It's done. So that, you know, there's obviously much more to object permanence, but that's kind of like, that's how it tends to manifest. That have a planner that you put, you know, like put onto a door that's on the inside of a door, doesn't exist. It's gone.
Yeah.
Gone. The list, like, for a while, we had the to-do list on magic whiteboard on our like office doors. I bet our cleaner thought we were bonkers because we had the. Do you know what magic whiteboard is? Is this like plastic sheets that stick onto any surface, and you can write on it with whiteboard markers.
Yeah.
So we had those, and I think I looked at them sometimes. They become sort of invisible as they're there longer.
Yes.
And I think she must have thought that we're mad. Just that we just have like basic things written on, like do this, do this, do this, and they're there for 4 weeks or whatever.
So the general standard routines people would take for granted, you've put on a whiteboard.
To-do lists that are on our door, and it looks ugly, but that's kind of the thing. It needs to look ugly to attract attention, and it still blends into the background eventually. So I have no idea where we got to that, but you know, yeah.
Well, you talked about object permanence and things being out of sight and out of mind. And I imagine in a mixed relationship between a neurodiverse and a neurotypical person, that kind of object permanence is quite frustrating. That lack of object permanence in us is frustrating. But also, it happens in time as well. So things that have happened in the past are in the past, and things that happen in the future. And they're not really necessarily that important.
Yeah, and I think there's also sometimes there are, I think the, when we use the term expressions, our ADHD expressions are different, that I have a better memory for things that I've said. Like we might have talked about something in at length, and then it is quite frustrating. It can be super frustrating when I can assume that we talked about it for 30 minutes. You know, like what route we were coming back from holiday. We talked about it for 30 minutes while we're taking that route. And you know, I researched it, you know, where we're going to stay and blah, 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 on a road trip. And then, you know, someone's like, oh, I don't why are we going this way? I have no idea. I'm like, really? We talked about it for ages. And it's like, but I understand. It is extra frustrating in some ways, extra challenging, because you know that you're not, you know you're imperfect in some ways, some similar ways, but it just happens to be not applicable in this particular case.
In that particular way, yeah.
And it's kind of like, I'm simultaneously dealing with the frustration. It's like, why the hell, why is it so hard for you? And at the same time, it's like, yes, but I understand why it's hard for you, but it's still hard for me. You know, it's like, that battle. Like, I understand, but it's still frustrating. And, you know, and I understand why that's hard for you, but it's not my job to take on that, because it's almost harder for me to do some of those things. It feels more unfair for me to take responsibility for, like, let's say, like running the household, the neurotypical tasks, because I am also challenged in these ways. So, like, it's not, he can't use the, you know, if we have a conversation, it's like, ah, but it's because it's ADHD. He's like, yes, but I'm also ADHD.
Yeah, so it's got to be done. Yeah,
but you can't use that card because in the same way, because, like, well, I'm also ADHD. So, but this stuff needs to be done. I'm trying to keep it PC. But it's like, it needs to be done. So we need to work together to find a way, because we both have ADHD, and it's you can't just go like, but I have ADHD. I find that really difficult. Like, yes, but so do I.
Yeah.
Ha ha. You know, like, you know. You know, they were at, you know, is it Chessmate or whatever, it's like, aha, well, we can't go, where do we go from here? It's hard for both of us, ha ha, you know, but it's stuff that needs to be done. So, you know, we have to be motivated to do those things. And yeah, I can't speak highly enough of the, you know, the benefits of having a coach in that kind of situation. Yeah, definitely.
It probably would be good to, when we wrap up, to share the details of your coach in case other people want to get in touch.
Oh, absolutely. Like, it's been, I would say that us independently working with him on our, like, it's not necessarily to do with productivity, but it's mostly to do with work things. However, those things would otherwise, they just live.
Yeah, there's no,
work is never separate. Yeah. And I think they have helped us to deal with some of the stuff in our personal lives, but we're going to take a much more practical approach to tackling that together. And I think I was explaining to someone that counselor or a therapist is, you know, that is what they are, but an actual coach is, I talk about it quite openly, because people are totally fine talking about how they have a personal trainer for physical stuff. So why don't you have a personal trainer for your work stuff? It's no, you know, it's no different to that you pay a personal trainer, someone pays a personal trainer to work out at the gym, to keep them, you know, keep them accountable and give them feedback on their progress and kind of mirror that. And, you know, anyone who says that, we're like, wow, clap, you know, hand clap for how proactive you are in looking after your physical health. Now, why don't we do the same thing with when it comes to your work-life health? Because that's a huge impact on the rest of your life. Is that how you're dealing with the pressures or the situations with your work life and your working styles and everything like that? We don't think about that. We think like, oh, but why would you need that? Shouldn't you be able to do that? Well, same thing. Shouldn't you be able to go to the gym without a personal trainer? He does that for, you know, it's like a mental gym in a way to kind of keep me accountable for the goals I want to have. And discuss like, well, actually, should we adjust the goals? Or maybe, you know, if we don't get there, why not? And kind of getting those new techniques. So it's exactly like, you know, it's like a personal trainer for your brain, really. And so now we're going to take that, you know, it's kind of just like doing your personal trainer with your partner. And it's the same things. Like, right, how are we going to solve these things and run this household like, you know, an executive team? So it's worth definitely worth every penny that we do. Penny, actually, he's the UK, so but he's awesome. And sometimes it's also helpful to know that he's like, do you know what, I used to work I've worked with a lot of, you know, CEOs and stuff, and you'd be surprised how disorganized they are as well with everyday stuff. I was like, oh, well, that's just, you know, the best part of today's session is to know that it's not just me. There are other people who look very successful and might not be
underneath it there.
Oh, that practical. So like, okay, so maybe I have, it helps to challenge whether you hold yourself to standards are way too high, because you assume you see everyone else's highlight reel. and you don't see the background scramble.
That's really true, actually. You do see everyone's highlight reel, and particularly on social media, of course.
Yeah.
And I think as a sort of neurodivergent person, you sort of think that you are, you know, automatically going to be worse at certain things. But actually, I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I think you're sort of conditioned to think that the way that you do things is the wrong way because it's not the typical way. And I suppose that's a sort of, it's really nice to have a professional who works with you who also is ADHD, because then or whatever neurodiversity you have, because then they have that same expectation that you can do as anything, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think that's our like joint goal this year, is to reduce the sort of low-level chaos that we naturally create. And you know, it's kind of also understanding that it doesn't have to be perfect. Even a 10% or 20% improvement in how we run the household business reduces the amount of overwhelm or the stress that comes from like looking at, like knowing that there's a to-do list that, you know, or projects that should be started and things like that. So it doesn't have to be perfect. Neither does your personal, your professional life. If you make improvements, small improvements all the time, like if you see 10, 20%, whatever improvement in your, how you do things, or at least, you know, 10, 20% of the time you do them more to your liking, then that's already better. Over time, it really adds up. And reducing the chaos and like stuff that's going around has been incredibly helpful for us. Moving out of the city and having a calmer lifestyle has had an enormous impact on us. So it's kind of little by little realized that I do not seem as ADHD anymore as I would have been 3 years ago, living in a city and living a different lifestyle, different job. So it makes a huge difference that you have a good fit with your surroundings and personal and working life. So, which you only realize afterwards, you think that life is always like that. Is how it is, but it doesn't have to be. You don't realize until you take yourself out of the environment, go like, oh, I'm now much calmer. Wow. So
Well, we've it's been a bit of a kind of gamble through all sorts of different topics. Fantastic insights that you've had, and probably, you know, in retrospect, we should have just brought you on as a solo guest and really dug into it. But thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Sharing your insights, and I think it's been really helpful for people who are sort of either neurodivergent themselves or living with someone who's neurodivergent, just to kind of some of the challenges and that really relentless practicality that you bring, which is really fantastic.
I think I don't know if I've always been like this, but I worked with someone who's an economist for a good almost 10 years, and I think some of that non-emotionality rubbed off on me. Like, yes, actually, that is quite a practical way to look at it. And being analytical about it. Sometimes it sounds odd when you say them out loud, but it works.
How would people get in touch with you? Are you a social media person, or have you got?
I think you can find me on Twitter from like Square Peg Mind. That's why my work stuff.
Square Peg Mind, nice.
Yeah, I will probably look at that a bit more. Yeah, my whole thing is like being a square peg in a round hole, that kind of thing. And that's probably a good way to find me. I will look at that much more often than something else. And it's been a real pleasure. I'm glad if it helps someone to kind of, you know, think about things differently. I may have made it sound easy, but it's always easy with hindsight.
No, I'm not sure you have. It's clearly a lot of work and a lot of struggle and compromise has gone into.
But kind of, you know, I think we've talked more about the struggle than the upsides. And I can't, you know, I should have mentioned that we also have a lot of fun. We're very silly, and we're very much on the same wavelength. We kind of sometimes think like we just can't be released to the outside world anymore with normal people. it's just like, and it's the being on the same wavelength with someone. It's just a, you know, it's It's very rewarding.
You can't, you can't replace it. Just that one time, that connection that we started with, that vibe or that energy.
That's why you do it.
That's why you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think both of us, we've said it many times. Like, it's like when we met, we felt like we were truly understood and seen for the first time. And I think part of that, you know, part of that is, it's like, I understand what it's like to be you. And some of the things that are come across as weird to a neurotypical when you're dating were totally normal for us. And the feeling of feeling normal and understood is and accepted is priceless. So that's why we put all the work into it, because, it, you know, it is worth all of that. However hard it is. So I'm actually glad we got to, you know, squeeze in the, you know, squeezing the good stuff. And it's actually made me a little bit emotional that just thinking about that. It's really the, I'm extremely sort of grateful that I met him, because I don't think I would necessarily feel the same kind of connection and with, you know, someone who isn't as ADHD as I am.
Neurotypical.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's, I stick with it. I would say to anyone who is, if you're lucky enough to find another one of your kind, that, you know, then it's worth the work.
So, stick with it. Great. Yeah, exactly. What a great message to end on. Thank you very much. Alina Hallinen, which I haven't mentioned your surname, which picked up the finish.
That's okay.
I should have picked up what's finish. Thank you very much for joining us. And goodbye. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
See, I told you she was brilliant. So that was another episode of Extraordinary Brains podcast. We are, as you probably may be aware, having a bit more of a relaxed episode release schedule this year. I've been ill constantly, Tess has been constantly busy, and the next few months, when she's got her GCSEs, it's unlikely that we'll be spending a huge amount of time on the podcast. We do still want people to come forward, however, even if we've got stuff in the bank to release in the summer, that's really cool. I think particularly interested if you want to recommend somebody you think is interesting in this area, because a lot of people are talking about how they are now, but actually their stories are collating their stories can be a really interesting exercise. So if you've got somebody you want to recommend, please let us know. Social media is usually the easiest, which is Extra Brains Pod in all of the different socials, or you can contact us through the website or by email. Anyway, I hope you're all well, and do get in touch. But other than that, we'll have in a week's time the second in our partners specials, which is going to be Nick Francis, the husband of Liz Francis, which is a much shorter but very nice chat with a very nice man. So looking forward to that, and see you soon. Bye bye.